I'm again honored to stand beside her on this stage and ask you to please help me in welcoming Compañera Medea Benjamin.
Wow. Thank you so much. When people ask me, don't I get depressed, and what do you do to not get depressed, I tell them to just come to Santa Cruz. First, let me just do a couple announcements so I don't forget. While we are out on the streets in Cancun talking about what we don't like of the World Trade Organization and working with delegations on the inside to stop that organization in its tracks, we're also trying to build the alternative economy we want to see. And some of you might know my husband, Kevin Danaher, who's been organizing these green festivals that bring together alternative businesses, green businesses, worker co-ops, the really positive economies that focus on local grown issues, local workforce, local community. And the next Green Festival in San Francisco is November 9th and 10th, so I hope you'll mark your calendars and all come up, because in addition to seeing hundreds and hundreds of positive examples of how we want our economy to be, there's also over 50 speakers from Alice Walker, Jim Hightower, our wild and wonderful governor candidate, Arianna Huffington, and probably Peter Cameo. So really great speakers there as well. I wanted to also update you on my travels, because Peter was talking about how I just got back from this whirlwind tour of the hotspots of the world. But I also stopped off in Los Angeles over the weekend. And part of that was to join my Code Pink comrades, who have been launching this wonderful campaign around Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I don't know how you feel, but I really don't want Arnold Schwarzenegger to be the next governor of California, do you? And it's amazing to me that he is considered a viable candidate when you look at his record on so many issues, but particularly on two issues, women and the environment. Women, I don't know how much you have seen, but you might want to go to the Code Pink website and take a look at some of the remarks that Arnold Schwarzenegger has made in some of his actions, not going back all the way to the mid-70s when he was just a poor, naughty boy and didn't know better, but going all the way up to about a month before he announced his candidacy. Pretty horrible things, and it is amazing that Hollywood and the whole state of California is letting him get away with those kind of remarks and attitudes towards women. And the other is the environment. This is a guy who is proud of having brought the Hummer from a military vehicle to a vehicle on the streets of our cities and towns. And I know that you all are very concerned about environmental issues here in Santa Cruz. And I get absolutely incensed every time I see a Hummer go by. I want to just get out and chain myself to it. But this is the guy who proudly talks about his marketing skills and making the Hummer a viable vehicle. And so we were in the Southern California on Sunday running around following Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the first place he was, the guy had the nerve to have a press conference overlooking the beautiful bluffs of Santa Barbara and to say that he was now Mr. Environment, he had seen the light, and he was going to convert his Hummers to hydrogen fuel cell Hummers. Have you seen this? Well, we all know how absolutely ridiculous that is, but boy, you know, there were a lot of people there saying, yes, Arnold, go, you know, a clean Hummer. So we were there with our signs and our voices, and as soon as Arnold started to speak, we started chanting as loud as we could, and there were only about 5 of us. The Hummer is not clean, and Arnold is not green. A Hummer is not clean, and Arnold is not green. And but we were loud as could be, and we took out the megaphone. And you know how the police usually go after us? Well, I got out the megaphone, and I was shouting this and drowning out Arnold, I must say. And suddenly, one of Arnold's big thugs was just right on top of me and tackled tackling me and grabbing the megaphone out of my hands and strangling me with the cord of the megaphone. And suddenly I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'll just go with this one. Not much I can do here. And suddenly the guy was gone, and the police were on top of him and tackling him to the ground, and everybody left Arnold. The press forgot all about Arnold and his Hummer for a while, ran after this, you know, exciting scene of the police tackling this big thug, and we decided we were going to go ahead and press charges on this guy. But it was one of those nice moments where the police did the right thing. But we have until October 7th to get out the word about Arnold. And one thing I'm asking you to do is, particularly the women in the room, to join us. We're going to have a day, statewide day, on October 3rd to say, Women Say No to Arnie. And I hope you will join us in that. So please contact Code Pink. It's codepinkalert.org, and you can find out any details, and maybe afterwards I could talk to a couple of women who might want to help organize that here. So that said, what's happening this week is quite remarkable in regards to the Bush administration and Iraq, because we have two major things going on. One is the Bush himself going before the United Nations to make his case to the world community. How many of you saw Bush or heard Bush's speech before the UN? Yeah, it makes you pretty ashamed. In fact, it made me really incensed because I wanted to watch it on television because I kind of like to see, you know, what the reaction is. And he was late getting on. And in the meantime, there was talks by other heads of state, Kofi Annan, was speaking, Lula da Silva, the head of Brazil, one of the most important countries in the world. But the mainstream media wouldn't let us hear what those leaders had to say. In fact, continued their banter back and forth among the co-hosts. Well, Bush is late, so we'll just have to chat about things like the weather and this and that. And you can see in the background, Lula speaking, Kofi Annan speaking, then Jacques Chirac speaking. We don't get to hear them. So, you know, when we talk about why the U.S. public is so misinformed, there was a perfect example. I'm sure the rest of the world got to hear Kofi Annan say that this reckless kind of policy, unilateral preemptive intervention, was throwing the world into possible chaos. And hearing Jacques Chirac say that this was not the way for an international community to work together. Hearing Lula da Silva talk about the kind of wars we should have, which is a war on poverty. So we don't get to hear what the rest of the world has to say. And that's just a constant that I see, and the schism between what people in this country hear and see and what the rest of the world hears and sees is only growing greater and greater and greater to our tremendous peril. So you had George Bush speaking before the United Nations with this real attitude of me, George Bush, and my administration were right. We had to go in post-September 11th and be strong. And even though he's not saying there's a direct connection between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, there he went and made the connection and said, you know, we had to go into Iraq and that we have liberated the people there, that things are going great. And now you and the world community, if you want to join us and kick in some soldiers for some more cannon fire, and if you want to throw in some funding in there, that would be nice. But we, the Bush administration, will maintain total control, total decision-making over Iraq, and forget the idea about passing the torch over to the Iraqis. They are not ready for that. So that goes on at the United Nations. Meanwhile, you have Congress. Well, they have gone before Congress, Paul Bremer, who is the viceroy in Iraq, going before Congress and saying, look, things are going pretty well. Yeah, there's a couple of problems in there, but, you know, it's manageable. We know what we're doing. We just need $87 billion more in order to do it. And it's wonderful that some Congress people are starting to speak up, but if you listen to what they're saying, it's quite remarkable. Because of the $87 billion, they're not questioning the vast majority of the money that's going to maintain the military there. They're saying, oh, yes, of course we got to give the money to the military. What they're questioning is the 17%, the $20 billion that's to go for rebuilding Iraq, and saying, well, you know, we need schools here in our own country. We need health care in our own country. Why should we be giving to Iraqis what we don't give to our own kids? Quite amazing what they pick to attack. Now, we've got to turn that around, and we've got to do it quickly. We've got to say, wait, this is reversed. Of course we should be paying especially for the damage that we caused in Iraq, and what we should be questioning is the $50 billion to keep the young men and women in harm's way in a place that they don't want to be, in a country that doesn't want them. That's what has to be questioned. There is some interesting things, though, happening in Congress, and this is just starting to come out, that the Congress people, a couple of them are asking, okay, well, where is this money going to come from? And one of the proposals on the table is that it comes from the tax cuts that Bush initiated, and that we take the richest 1% of the U.S. population and reduce their tax cuts to pay for, at least on our part, the $20 billion for the rebuilding of the damage caused by the U.S. invasion. So that's something that I think we should be supportive of. I want to talk more about what's actually happening in Iraq. And somebody said to me, I think it was Rosie from the interview that you did, isn't this just preaching to the choir? And one, it's a beautiful choir, so we're not preaching to such a lovely choir. But the other is that we need some more in-depth knowledge about what's actually going on in Iraq so that we can convey that information to other people who are still very unsure about this question of, well, we're in there now, maybe the U.S. troops should stay there, maybe the Iraqis aren't prepared for self-government, those kind of things. And I also think it's important because many of you in Santa Cruz are involved in two movements that haven't been combined in other parts of the country like they've been combined in Santa Cruz. And that is the movement against corporate-led globalization, as epitomized by the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the Bush administration, the corporate agenda in general that says that we should run this beautiful globe of ours according to the dictates of corporations and their love of money, instead of what we as human beings feel should be run according to the benefits of the people on this planet as well as the Mother Nature. And so this movement against corporate-dominated globalization has, in other places in the country, been separate from the peace movement. And one of the reasons I love Santa Cruz so much is that you see those two movements as one. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what's happening in Iraq, because you can see in such raw, brutal form how the forces of military domination pave the way for economic domination. And while we might disagree with many, many things that the writer and columnist Thomas Friedman had to say, he did say something very smart, which is that you can't have the hidden hand of the market without the, he said, hidden fist, I wouldn't say it's very hidden, of the military might. And he said you can't have McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas. Well, in the case of Iraq, we see it in its most raw form. So I know that people are very clear about the U.S. military intervention. What you might not be as clear about is the aftermath of the U.S. military intervention and what it's meant for the Iraqi people, the Iraqi economy in particular. So I want to show you some pictures. This first one is of a government ministry building. Now, we heard about the targeted airstrikes during the war. And I must say that when I went to Afghanistan after the bombing there, I came back saying, what are we talking about smart bombs? These bombs are not smart at all. They hit residential neighborhoods. They killed thousands of innocent civilians. But what I saw in Baghdad, at least, was in some areas a really remarkable precision targeting of government buildings, because you could go through neighborhoods and see the buildings intact except for this one government building. And there were dozens of government buildings that were targeted. So you think, well, you know, so what's so bad about that, a government building that's targeted? What I didn't understand until I got there, and I've been there now three times in the last 6 months, is what it means when you target government institutions. Because the U.S. government said, well, we are targeting what was the outposts of Saddam Hussein. Well, the Ministry of Public Education, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Transportation, the Ministry of Telecommunications, these are not the outposts of Saddam Hussein. These are the structures that kept the records for the entire country. You take something like the Ministry of Public Health and destroy the records, how are you going to have a public health system? You destroy the records of education. How are you going to have a public education system? You destroyed the telecommunications building. You've destroyed the major way that people are able to have their telephone lines accessed to communicate with each other. I'm sure Saddam Hussein had other ways to communicate than through the phone lines. So you see that by targeting the ministries, they really targeted the heart of the infrastructure of the economy. Now think of what this economy was already, because it was three decades of a brutal dictatorship that led them from a middle-class society in the 60s and the 70s, when Iraq was considered a place that people had a very good education, had a pretty high standard of living. Then came the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, which was devastating, both the number of people that were killed as well as what it did to the economy. And from there came the invasion of Kuwait, the Gulf War, the devastation in the wake of the Gulf War, and then 13 years of brutal sanctions. So this is an economy that has been buffeted, that has been in tremendous dire straits, people hanging on barely, and then comes the U.S. invasion. Now, with the U.S. invasion, many people thought that perhaps there would be some relief, because they did understand that it was the United States that was imposing the sanctions on them, and that if the United States was able to get rid of Saddam Hussein and then lift the sanctions, that perhaps their lives would be better. But lo and behold, the U.S. targeting of these government ministries meant a devastation of the basic infrastructure. And on top of that, it wasn't just the bombing. It was the looting that followed. Now, the U.S. says the looting, in fact, Donald Rumsfeld called the looting a little untidiness that comes with democracy. Well, let me tell you, this was not untidiness. And Iraqis will tell you that the U.S. not only looked the other way when the looting started, but actually facilitated some of the looting. And in fact, when you look at these government buildings, and here's another one that's the Ministry of Electricity, the bombs hit the building, and then people came in and took out every piece of anything that had any value from these buildings. For example, in this next slide that I want to show you, it's kids, yeah, but you'll see. It looks like a bunch of nice kids. They are a bunch of nice kids, actually, but this is the marble that is coming out of one of the government buildings, and they're taking out every last piece of marble, every last piece of wiring, everything that they can get out of these buildings. There's a term called Alibaba, you know, Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. Well, the Iraqis first started using the term to talk to people from the outside to talk about the thieves, but now they commonly use the term Alibaba to mean a thief. And these guys said, yeah, we're Alibabas, but we're nice Alibabas. So these were nice thieves that were looting this government building. This is the petty thievery, but there was large-scale thievery that was going on, big Alibabas, and that was happening right under the nose of the United States. For example, how would you get into the banks? The banks have these heavy vaults. So the Iraqis said that Iraqis alone couldn't break open those vaults, and told us of U.S. tanks going through the vaults to open the way so that the Iraqis could get in and then loot the banks. Banks were totally devastated, and this that you see here in this picture of these men sitting outside in the street with stacks of money, that is now the banking system outside in the street. When you think about the looting of the basic infrastructure, the big-scale looting, Think of factories that existed and the machinery that's in factories, cranes for construction, cement rigs, big machinery that would cost $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. These things were stolen, taken out of the country, crossing the border, going to the Kurdish territories and into Iran, right under the noses of the U.S. soldiers that were controlling the border. You have to ask yourself, why did they allow the entire whole-scale looting of this country? And one of the questions is, was this done on purpose? Now, the Bush administration has said that the economy in Iraq was a value-destroying economy. Among the things that existed under Saddam Hussein, in addition to being a brutal dictator, or despite being a brutal dictator, we might say, was an education system that was free all the way through college, a healthcare system that was basically free, a ration system that provided everybody in Iraq, 24 million people, with the basics to keep them from starving during the years of the sanctions. That, according to the Bush administration, is a value-destroying system. And so what they want to do is raise the basic economy, get rid of the basic economy, and put a value-creating system in its place. Well, one of the ways they're doing that is really destroying the ability of businesses to function. So I talked about the looting. The other thing is, why isn't there basic services in Iraq? This is a picture here of a typical street in downtown Baghdad, where you see the garbage just strewn out in the street. No garbage collection. No, the sewage system not working. But the worst thing is the issue of electricity, because if you don't have electricity, it is very, very difficult to function. Now, electricity also, remember, not having electricity during the summer months, how devastating that is. Remember when the Bush administration was having us run in circles and circles and circles saying that this was about weapons of mass destruction, and there we were saying, allow the inspectors in and give the inspectors time, and Bush was saying, no, time is running out, because it was going to get very hot in Iraq. And he didn't want to wait until it was too hot for the troops to invade. So that's why the invasion happened in the months before the most brutal summer heat. Well, they invaded and they destroyed the electrical grid, and guess who is suffering now? The Iraqi people. When you talk about the weather, we had a heat spell here last week. It went up over 100 degrees. That's nothing. That's nothing to what hot weather is in Iraq. Hot weather in Iraq, you're talking about 120 degrees. And remember, I talked about a society that had been a middle-class society that was used to things like air conditioning and fans, that found it almost impossible to sleep at night in the suffocating heat, that also found it impossible to keep their food because you didn't have your appliances working, the refrigerators were broken because of the power surges, not clean water because you didn't have the pumping of the water supply. And here is a picture of a line at the gas station. Now, this is a quite remarkable thing because remember, we're talking about a country that has the second largest gas reserves, oil reserves in the entire world. A country where people had gasoline at prices like 10 cents a gallon. And to now find that because they didn't have electricity and the pumps in the gas station aren't working, that it's hard for them to fill up their gas tanks. And so you had people who were waiting online for gasoline, not just 4 or 5 hours in the brutal heat, but sometimes up to 24 hours just to get some gasoline in a country that is basically floating on oil. You can imagine how the Iraqis feel about that kind of humiliation. I talk about how the businesses have been devastated, particularly the local businesses, because if you don't have electricity, how are you going to open up your stores? How are you going to function as a business? Well, it's very difficult for Iraqi businesses to function. In the meantime, they are faced with competition now from businesses all over the world, because one of the first decrees of the Bush administration in Iraq was to lift the tariffs on all imported goods. So suddenly, goods were floating into Iraq across the border, out-competing the Iraqi businesses. So if you go into a small business like the one you see on the screen right now and try to get something that is made in Iraq, it's almost impossible. To think that in the course of only 5 or 6 months, this country went from going into a store and asking for Iraqi goods and being able to find them to not being able to find Iraqi goods. For example, I have a friend who is a woman who is very, very addicted to her own country and her own culture and the things that her country once produced. And she would go into the store and say, I want to buy a headscarf, and I want it to be an Iraqi headscarf. She can no longer find Iraqi headscarves. They're now coming in from China. When she wants to buy a can of tomato paste, something that she has always bought from Iraq, she can't find a can of tomato paste anymore because now it's coming in from countries like Saudi Arabia or Jordan. The same thing for a can of soda that before was made in Iraq. You can't find it Iraqi made anymore. Devastating to local businesses. The other thing that has been devastating to the local population is the issue of employment. When the U.S. administration came into Iraq, what did they do? First of all, let's just take the army. The army was composed of 400,000 people. Well, the U.S. had, through all different means, tried to reach the rank and file and higher-ups in the army and said, don't fight. They released millions of pieces of paper of propaganda. They got on the radio and programs like Voice of America, and they said, look, if you join us in the struggle against this brutal dictator, and we together liberate the country, your lives will be better. Now, many people in the army believe that, and they believe that and went along with it for a few reasons. One is many people in the army hated Saddam Hussein as well. And they hated Saddam Hussein because he had taken them into these brutal wars in Iran and afterwards in Kuwait. And they had seen so many of their comrades die for nothing. The other thing is they knew they couldn't beat the United States and the U.S. technology. They knew it wouldn't be worth it to get slaughtered by the U.S. bombs. And the last thing was that they also thought that if they laid down their arms, they would be greeted with open arms by the U.S. and would be considered allies in getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Well, little did they know when the U.S. came in, instead of treating this army that defected, that didn't fight, as their allies, as, quote, co-liberators, instead they dismissed the entire army, 400,000 people. Now think, the average family size is 5. That's 2 million people that had no longer any way to feed themselves. 400,000 people very angry at the United States administration, 400,000 people who had been trained to fight and are very angry at the United States. It was not a very smart policy. The other thing the U.S. did was to dismiss the entire police force. Now, I've said to some people, imagine if suddenly you woke up and there were no police, and they say, wow, that would be wonderful. But you know what? It doesn't really work like that. Because when you have absolute chaos, when there is a breakdown in law and order, somebody can come in as they're doing every day in homes in Iraq and put guns to people's head and say, everything you have here is now mine. Put a gun to their head in the street in the broad daylight while the Iraqis are driving their cars and say, get out of your car, this car is now mine. Also, the way that it has allowed for a proliferation of something very new in Iraq, and that's rapes and abductions. And women are terrified to come out of their homes because of the lack of law and order. So when you have this total breakdown in society, it is very devastating for the most vulnerable people in that society. So people have been thrown out of their jobs. People have lost their pensions. This picture here is a picture of people who were formerly veterans of foreign wars and lived off of pensions. But when the U.S. came in, they found they no longer had access to those pensions anymore, had, again, no way to feed themselves. Well, you say, what about reconstituting the Iraqi police force? Isn't this something that the U.S. realizes that must be done quickly? Well, they're doing it, but they're doing it at a painfully slow rate. And what you see in this picture are a couple of policemen that we are sitting here talking to. Well, these policemen are lucky because some of them have uniforms. Not all of them have uniforms. But what they haven't been issued is guns. Well, anybody can go on the black market and buy themselves a gun. You can buy a rocket-propelled grenade, you can buy an AK-47, you can buy just about anything you want on the black market very cheap. But here, a reconstituted police force has not been issued guns. So there's no way that they can stop the looting or the abductions or the rapes. It's funny because there are certain areas of Baghdad that are considered very, very, very dangerous, the Wild West. And we were told, don't go into those neighborhoods, don't go into those neighborhoods. And of course, we wanted to see what it was like for the Iraqis to live in those neighborhoods. So we decided to go into all of the neighborhoods they told us not to go to. The first one that we went to used to be called Saddam City, and after Saddam left, it was called Sadr City, after one of the Shia clerics. And this was an area of the Shia community, very oppressed by Saddam Hussein, extremely poor area of Baghdad. Well, when we went, we thought, well, why don't we stop in the local police station first and ask some of the policemen if they would accompany us on a trip around their section of the city. So we got to the police station, and they thought that was very funny that we wanted them to accompany us, because they said, well, you know, we don't have any weapons. If somebody's going to come and try to, you know, steal from you or do something to you, we're just going to run the other way. I always say, okay, but, you know, you look like a little bit of a deterrent. Why don't you just come out with us? Plus, it's your neighborhood. You know it. You can show us around. So they were extremely nice, and as you might see in this picture, they have little dog tags on, these yellow dog tags. And while they haven't been issued guns, they have been issued dog tags. So we asked to see their dog tags and what they said. And their dog tags said, well, here, this is their name, this is their rank, that they are part of the new, liberated, reconstituted, Saddam-free police force, and that if you find this dog tag, please return it to such and such a place. Anybody want to venture a guess what language this dog tag is written in? English only. English only. So these nice policemen were saying, could you translate for me what it says on this thing around my neck? It's just another example of the incredible insensitivity of the U.S. occupying forces. One of the things I'm not going to get into what this picture is yet, but when we talk about the economy, I talk about the devastation of the economy and that there's no police force there to even protect the businesses so they feel comfortable opening their establishments. The other thing is that I mentioned the unemployment issue. I talked about the police force being disbanded, the army being disbanded, but you might have also heard of the de-bathification program. The de-bathification program is supposed to be getting rid of people who were collaborators with Saddam Hussein's regime. Now, it might sound good, but in practice, what has happened is that tens and tens of thousands of people have been thrown out of their jobs because they were members of the Ba'ath Party. And oftentimes, some of the higher-level people have been kept in their positions. So you have instances where many, many of the most skilled people in the country, the people who could fix the electrical grid, get the phone system back working, get the water supply system back, have been dismissed from their jobs because they were members of the Ba'ath Party. Now, remember, for most of these Iraqis, they had to become members of the Ba'ath Party just to get these government jobs. And that's true of teachers, it's true of professors. Thousands of professors have been thrown out of their job, and the school season has just started again, and the students are now complaining that they don't have enough teachers. This goes down all the way to the high school level. And I want to tell a story of a friend of mine whose son is in high school. Son goes back to school and finds that his favorite English teacher has been dismissed from his job because he was a member of the Ba'ath Party. His favorite physics teacher dismissed from his job because he was a member of the Ba'ath Party. And this friend, the father of boy in the school, was so incensed by what he saw happening, that he went home and he said, the first thing I did was defy one of the edicts of the United States, which says we're not allowed to have photos of Saddam Hussein. And he said, I went home and I printed off my computer and I enlarged this big picture of Saddam Hussein and I put it right in front of my house. And he said, but it wasn't any picture of Saddam Hussein. It was a picture of Saddam Hussein shaking hands with Donald Rumsfeld. And this picture was from 1983. Now, he said, you have to know a couple of things. One is that 1983 was the height of the brutality of Saddam Hussein's regime. You also have to know that somebody like Donald Rumsfeld had access to Amnesty International reports, Human Rights Watch reports, and State Department reports that in 1980, 1981, 82, and 83 all talked about how brutal the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein was. But despite that, here comes Donald Rumsfeld, an envoy from the U.S. government, to shake hands with Saddam Hussein and say, this is a guy that we can work with. Now, why is it that they are dismissing my son's English school teacher, who had no access to Amnesty reports, Human Rights Watch reports, State Department reports, had no idea what was even happening in his own country? So let us be rational about this de-bathification program. If we are going to start to dismiss people and perhaps try them for their collaboration with Saddam Hussein's regime, let's not start with my son's English teacher. Let's start with Donald Rumsfeld. And, of course, this man was smart enough to say right there we should go to Dick Cheney because his company, Halliburton, was trading with Saddam Hussein during the years of the most brutal part of this dictatorship. And that gets me to the economic issues that once you get rid of people who know how to fix their country, who know how to teach the young people, who comes in the place to define the new economic system? Well, remember that the U.S. has taken control of all of the ministries of Iraq right now. Ministry of Transportation, Communication, Commerce, and of course the only ministry that wasn't destroyed, which is the Ministry of Oil. So who was brought in to run these ministries? Well, with the U.S. passport, you can not only get in to the country of Iraq, but you can get into Saddam Hussein's old palaces, the Republican Palace. And it is, let me tell you, still a Republican palace. It's just not Saddam Hussein's. It's George Bush's Republican palace right now. You go into the Republican palace now in Baghdad, just with the U.S. passport. That gets you inside. You can go swimming in Saddam Hussein's pool. You can bring your laundry and have it dry cleaned in Kuwait. You can get a free cell phone that allows you to call anywhere in the world. A lot of advantages in Saddam Hussein's old presidential palace, but now the advantages are for people from the United States. And those who are brought in to run this economy were cronies of George Bush. Now, let's remember who George Bush was and is, a failed Texas businessman. He brought in his cronies, who were other failed Texas businessmen, to run Iraq. And let's be clear, if you were a successful Texas businessman, you wouldn't want to be relocated to Iraq right now. So he brings in these guys who have never done anything successful in their lives and give them entire ministries for this country that they're supposed to run. Now, these are people who never been to Iraq, most of them never been to the Middle East, most of them had never had passports in their lives before, don't know anything about this beautiful country with thousands of years of incredible history, don't know anything about the ethnicity, about the religion, don't speak the language, don't even try to speak the language, and they are in their bubble in this presidential palace, making rules, passing edicts, rewriting legislation for the Iraqi economy, and also appointing a puppet government called the Governing Council to carry out their decrees. And what they have just done is absolutely remarkable. Before there is a constitution written, before there is an elected government, they are rewriting the investment laws of that country. Now, the investment law in Iraq was that Western companies could not invest in Iraq. You can be sure that that is the first thing that is being rewritten. And the way they are rewriting it now is 100% ownership for any foreign corporation. Immediate and full repatriation of any profits. It's giving the 192 state-owned companies off to the highest bidder, privatization. Now, they haven't been able to say yet that they will privatize oil, which, believe you me, was on the agenda. But what they found out, two things. One is they found out that Iraqis really don't want their oil to be privatized, that that's across the board, even among the puppets that they have appointed in this governing council. And the other, which is perhaps more important to the Bush administration, is that when they went around talking to oil companies saying, okay, you know, who's going to pony up now and invest in Iraq and you'll get a piece of the pie, the companies are saying, huh, are you crazy? Invest in Iraq? In that big mess, in that unstable mess that you've created? I don't think so. So U.S. oil companies do not, at this point, want to start putting billions of their dollars into Iraq. So everything but the oil industry is now considered ripe for the picking by foreign corporations. And just think what this means to this poor country that has been so devastated. That instead of saying that now we will have Iraq for the Iraqis, instead of saying now that the oil money and the resources of this entire nation will be for the people who have suffered so much, instead of saying that we will have investment laws that will favor Iraqis, no, these are investment laws that favor foreign corporations. And so you see right now what is happening is quite remarkable. There is a group of people coming to complain in a loud voice about this, and it goes from the unemployed to workers to business people. The unemployed are now starting to organize. They're organizing in groups like the Union of the Unemployed that is starting to organize protests and sit in 24 hours a day in front of the very presidential palace where the U.S. is functioning. And there's workers who are now going on strike in their businesses to say, we do not want this to happen. We do not want to see our business privatized because we think we will be out of jobs. And the businessmen are saying, wait a minute, we thought we were going to get a cut of this. We thought we were going to be able to get the subcontracts from Halliburton and Bechtel. We thought this was going to benefit us. And lo and behold, they find no, that it's the Halliburtons and the Bechtels and the MCI WorldComs, it's the U.S. companies and their friends in other countries that are going to be the ones right now to benefit. But the positive thing is that there is resistance. And you can imagine with this kind of scenario what the resistance is. Now, of course, we hear about the armed resistance, and I want to talk a minute about that armed resistance. But I also want to move on to the non-armed, non-violent resistance, which is something we don't hear about. Wait a minute. In terms of armed resistance, you hear about the soldiers being attacked on a daily basis. When we first got to Iraq in July, we were told that there, by the U.S. military, that there were 13 attacks every day on U.S. soldiers. When we left 2 weeks later, they told us there were 25 attacks every day on U.S. soldiers. This is a picture of what was one of Schwarzenegger's favorite vehicles, a Hummer. We were going down the street and heard this biggest explosion and then came upon this flattened out piece of metal was a Hummer. There were four U.S. soldiers in there, all of them obliterated. The U.S. soldiers. This is a memorial we went to in the presidential palace for one of the U.S. soldiers. This was a boy, a young man who went to buy a Pepsi and was shot in the head. At the memorial service, they talked about he died in the glorious fight against terrorism post 9/11. And we talked to some of the soldiers in this memorial. And let me tell you, many of them are seeing through what the Bush administration is saying. Many of them are desperate to get themselves out of there. And that is one of the bright spots right now because we tried very hard to talk to soldiers every single day. I talked about the heat. Imagine with the kind of outfits that the soldiers are wearing, where their flak jackets alone, when it's 110 degrees outside, it was 125 degrees in their flak jackets. They would be going out in patrols 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, being sitting ducks. They, I thought, had better conditions than the Iraqi population and would go home at least to some air-conditioned barracks. They would laugh. They say, we don't have running water. We don't have showers. We don't have air-conditioned barracks. We can't sleep at night either because it's too hot. They said they were in cots that were infested with mites. They said they were given a liter and a half of clean drinking water every day, and the rest was coming out of these big barrels full of chlorine and hot from being out in the sun, almost undrinkable. They were miserable. And many of them said, look, I came here because I thought we were liberating people from Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein is not in power anymore. I don't understand why we're here anymore. We're not trained for this. We don't know what we're doing. The Iraqi people are shooting at us every day. They don't want us here. We don't want to be here. And when we talked to them about what we were doing, setting up this Occupation Watch Center, at first we were afraid to tell them, and we'd say, they'd say, what are you doing here? And we said, oh, we're one of those humanitarian do-good organizations, you know. And after we heard their complaints, we realized that we should just tell them we were here setting up an Occupation Watch Center that had the goal of trying to end the occupation as soon as possible. And they'd say, right on, here's the number of my mother, here's my girlfriend, here's my wife. I'm sure they'd want to work with you when you get back to the States. Please call them. So we have to understand the potential in this, and the potential is huge. And many of you have heard of the group Military Families Speak Out, an absolutely amazing, amazing group. And I had a wonderful conversation with one of the members of that group today, who is of Mexican origin, lives in San Diego. His name is Fernando Suarez. He lost his son, Jesus, in this occupation in Iraq. And he called me up and said, I know you just came back from another trip to Iraq. I really want to go. Can you organize a trip for military families? And I am so excited about that. We've already picked a date. We've already have a number of other family members just today alone that said they wanted to go. And when I asked him why he wanted to go to Iraq, he said, started to cry on the phone, and he said, first of all, I want to apologize to the Iraqi people and tell them that there are many, many peace-loving people in the United States who knew that this wasn't the right way to go about getting rid of a dictator. And the other thing I want to do is go to the U.S. troops and tell them that we love them, and because we love them, we want them to come home. And I asked him if he wanted to speak to or tried to speak to anybody high up in the U.S. command. And he thought for a minute, and then he said, yes, I would, and I have a special reason for wanting to do that. I said, what? He said, I don't know how my son died, and I think they ought to tell me. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, somebody in the military told me that he got shot by an Iraqi. And then some of his friends told me that he stepped on a U.S. landmine. He said, that's very different stories. I don't even know where my son was killed. He said, I think I have the right to know the truth. But you know what he really, really wanted to do? He wanted to talk to ordinary Iraqis. He really wanted to talk to young people. He said, if you could get me in as many schools as I could go to, I would love that. Because we have to talk to the young people in this country, like he's doing, and we have to talk to young people in Iraq, and we have to tell them that war is not the answer, that this is not the right way to change the world, and that we in the U.S. have to stop our government from its militaristic policies, and we have to show the Iraqi people that we are determined to change our government and determined to help the Iraqis have a government that really represents the best of the Iraqi people. So I'm very, very excited about that trip with military families, and I think it can make a huge, huge influence on the media, on the way that many Americans are viewing this occupation of Iraq. I talked about how the military are in many ways allies of ours, but let's also remember that the military are doing some really bad things in Iraq right now, and I saw that on a daily basis. In this picture, you can see an altercation between an Iraqi man and the U.S. military. Now, you can just feel the tension from this picture. And this is something we just caught on camera by chance, but this is something we saw every day, several times a day. Imagine at a checkpoint in your own country, you're stopped by an 18-year-old from, you know, Alabama, Tennessee, that says, "Get out! Stand up! Open your trunk! Do this! Do that!" The Iraqis don't speak English. They don't know what they're being told to do. And so many times at the checkpoints, the soldiers, because the Iraqis are not responding, get out their guns and shoot. People are being killed at the checkpoints, they're being maimed at those checkpoints, and they're being humiliated on a daily basis at those checkpoints. There's also the raids that are taking place on a regular basis and the detaining of Iraqis on a regular basis. And I heard Donald Rumsfeld say himself that they were rounding up hundreds of people every single day. Now, in the prisons, Saddam Hussein's old prisons are full of thousands of Iraqis that are being picked up on the street, detained without charges, held indefinitely, not given access to lawyers, not allowing their families to even know where they are, much less visiting them. Now, this is by the occupying force that says that it's bringing democracy to Iraq. It sounds like the rounding up of people in this country. It sounds like the people who are being detained indefinitely in Guantanamo. And the same thing is happening in Iraq. It's absolutely amazing that the U.S. thinks that it can get away with this gross violation of the Geneva Conventions, of international law, of the basics of human rights that it is doing in Iraq right now. Well, this brings me to the issue of the Occupation Watch Center. And the goal of the Occupation Watch Center is to stop the daily abuses of the occupying forces, to track what's happening around the economy and try to stop the invasion of U.S. corporations, and also to work with people in this country and around the world to stop the occupation. And we're doing it in a number of different ways. The Occupation Watch Center exists in Baghdad. It's an actual center. And when we went there, we didn't know whether the Iraqis would feel comfortable working with us on this or if they would be too afraid of the Americans to be out there doing this kind of work. We thought perhaps it would have to be people from the international community. And we got together an international group from Japan, from Australia, from Lebanon, from Italy. We're all coming together to create this Occupation Watch Center. We go there and we start talking to Iraqis. And they say, "This is a wonderful idea. We need to create such a center. But you know what? It has to be run by Iraqis." And they have taken charge. In fact, we have two feisty women as co-directors of this center that are putting their lives on the line every day, going out and confronting the U.S. military. So here you see a typical picture of a U.S. Military patrol rolling down the streets of the cities of Iraq every day with their tanks and with their machine guns pointed right in the faces of the Iraqi people. Now remember, they're being attacked. The U.S. soldiers are being attacked. And remember, they are jittery. And they feel now that they can't trust anyone, that every Iraqi man, woman, young, old, is a potential sniper. So there they are going through the streets of Baghdad with their weapons aimed at the population, and they hear gunshots. Well, you hear gunshots all the time in Iraq now. It could be snipers trying to hit someone in the military. It could be thieves because there are lots of them. And it could be a wedding party. It could be many things. The U.S. patrols hear the gunshots, and they react immediately, and they shoot out into the population. And they shoot out indiscriminately. They use excessive force. And so on a daily basis, in one hospital alone, the Al-Kindi Hospital in Baghdad, they are reporting 20 to 30 people coming in suffering from gunshots wounds from the occupying forces on a daily basis. Now, that is what we're not hearing about in the U.S. press. And so one of the things that we're doing as part of the Occupation Watch is taking testimonies from Iraqis about what is happening in the use of indiscriminate force, and then confronting the U.S. military with this. For example, you'll see in this photo a picture of an Iraqi family holding a picture of the husband. Now, this man was a doctor. He got up one morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, turned on his car. The car didn't work. Decided to go stand in the street to take a taxi to get to work. He's standing there waiting for a taxi. A U.S. patrol goes by. He's holding his day book in his hand. They think it's a pistol. They shoot 8 bullets into his chest. He's lying dead on the street. This family is absolutely devastated. He was the breadwinner for the entire family, not only his 2 tiny children, 2 years old and 4 years old, but also his elderly grandparents. The worst of it all was also the way that the family was treated, because the U.S. troops accused this man of being a sniper or being a thief. Why was he carrying a gun? He had no gun. The family said he didn't own a gun. He never used a gun in his life. Trying to malign the character of this man, trying to pretend that they were being shot at. So we are working with this family to confront the U.S. military, to demand the truth about how he was killed, to demand that there be compensation for this family, and to demand, most importantly, that the troops stop shooting civilians. And we are doing this in many ways. We have U.S. lawyers that are going to Iraq, working with Iraqi lawyers to figure out how they can confront the U.S. military. We are also going into the press conferences of the military with our press passes, like we did when we were there, unfurling a banner in the middle of a press conference by Colonel Sanchez saying, "Stop the killing, stop the killing, stop the killing." We're looking for all the ways that we can to force the U.S. troops to stop the indiscriminate use of force, to stop the daily detentions. We're going to the prisons and demanding that lists be circulated, that these prisoners have access to lawyers, that they either be charged or released, that their families be informed of where they are. This is one of the major activities of the Occupation Watch Center. The other thing we're doing is working with women. I told you about how women are so fearful right now. Many people in the United States have no idea that Iraqi women, before Saddam Hussein and during the regime of Saddam Hussein, were very accomplished women. They were doctors, they were lawyers, they were engineers, they were teachers, they sold in the marketplace, they bought in the marketplace. Unlike many parts of the Middle East, they had a very prominent and public role in their society. Right now, women are living in fear, many of them prisoners in their own home, afraid to go outside. And so we are working with new Iraqi women's organizations that are forming, saying that we will not live like this. We refuse to be prisoners in our own home. We refuse to have a society that is total chaos. We demand that there be some law and order. We demand that women be represented in any new kind of government. They look at the governing council that's been hand-selected by the U.S. and see only 3 women, and 3 women who are not known for their work in the women's community. They see that there is a committee that's been appointed to rewrite the Constitution, and there are 0 women in that committee. So these women's groups are starting to organize, to form, and make demands. This picture is one protest where women were coming out to make these demands. And at this protest, it was really wonderful because there's one woman who you can't see here, but she was the leader of the protest, a young, feisty woman called Yanar. She's, I think, smaller than me. And she organized this protest at the very site. Remember the place where Saddam Hussein's statue was, the staged falling down of that statue that was shown over and over and over again? In that very square, which is where this protest is taking place, she got these women out. Well, while the women were gathering, U.S. troops came up with their tanks and with their machine guns, got out, stormed up, and said, "Where is your permit? Don't you know that the orders say that you cannot hold any kind of demonstration, any kind of public gathering without a permit?" So this one woman, Yanar, looks at these guys, these big hulks of guys, and she says to them, she speaks perfect English, "You've got to be kidding me." She said, "You're asking me for a permit? Do you know whose country this is?" She said, "Where is your permit to be in my country?" And they did not know what to do, and they just kind of withered away, and the demonstration went on. These are the kind of women that are organizing in Iraq today. The final area I want to talk about for Occupation Watch is what can we do around the economy. I mentioned that there was a food ration system that was giving food out on a monthly basis to 24 million Iraqis, the entire population. This is the only reason that Iraqis are not starving to death right now. Well, this ration system is supposed to end, according to the Bush administration, by the end of the year, because that is a value-destroying system to give people food, that really it's the free market that is value-creating, and people have to learn to work and to get jobs and to go to the market and to buy their food. So we are doing a survey right now talking to Iraqis about what would happen if they didn't have this ration system. This family, what they're eating right now is basically things that they get on their monthly ration. When we asked them what would happen, they had no idea that there was even a contemplation that that ration system was end. And here is a picture of me out interviewing people in the street when they're getting their rations, saying, "What would happen to you if you didn't have their ration?" Well, it was very interesting because a couple of the women would say, "Well, not have the ration, our families would starve." But more of the women would respond, "No ration. There would be food riots, and then they would have to put the ration system back in place." Isn't it interesting that a country that had been living under the yoke of a repressive dictatorship has somehow become accustomed to some basic things like food and health care, and says that they will riot if they don't have access to that food and health care? So one of the things that we're doing is going to release a report about the plans of the Bush administration to get rid of this food ration system, to release it in Iraq so that people know what these plans are, so that they don't have to have an end to the food system and then have to undergo things like riots, but we can stop the Bush administration in its tracks, demand that there continue to be a ration system until there is a functioning economy, until people have jobs, until agriculture is up and running again. And I think establishing the right to food in Iraq might have some good trickle-down effect for the right to food in places like this country. So finally, I talked about this famous square in Iraq that is where the statue of Saddam Hussein came tumbling down for the U.S. cameras. Well, what you don't see on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or more is what has replaced that statue of Saddam Hussein. And there is a statue that young students in the university had put up, and then after they put the new statue up, they wrote on the column, "All done. Go home." Now, I wonder why Fox News isn't showing this over and over and over again. Of course, this was in July when we were there. When we went back in August, the U.S. military had painted over the all done go home. But they can't paint over the sentiments of the Iraqi people. And the sentiments of the Iraqi people are very strong. They do not want to be occupied. They are resisting in all kinds of creative ways. In addition to the armed resistance, there is the resistance that I mentioned of the unemployed. There's resistance of the women's community. There's resistance from the human rights communities. There's resistance now building among the university students and the high school students because they come back to school right this fall and they find that there's military on their campus. And just like students in our campuses and our high schools are trying to say military out of our schools, so the Iraqi students are trying to make their schools a military-free zone. So there is a lot of wonderful organizing going on in Iraq. And while we might feel that things are pretty bleak when we look at it from the vantage point of the Bush administration, I think that I actually come home from Iraq inspired by the Iraqis who I meet, who are doing all kinds of creative resistance to the occupation, and how we, through Occupation Watch, can work with them to get these issues out to the international community and build up the kind of strong movement that we had to try to stop the war into a strong movement to end this occupation. And if you look at what we have before us in the fall right now and for this coming year, it's an incredible opportunity. It's an amazing opportunity to organize not only to help free the Iraqi people of the yoke of an occupying force, turn it over to the United Nations, which is the only legitimate organization to oversee a transition to democracy, and have a quick timetable for elections and Iraqi self-rule. But that goes hand in hand with the struggle that we have to wage here in the United States to show what the Bush administration did in lying to the American public to get us into this war. We knew it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, and here they are 6 months later without even being able to find or even plant and then find any weapons of mass destruction. That's how incompetent they are. They can't even plant them. And then there is this issue of the daily cost in lives to the U.S. troops. How long can that be going without an uprising among the troops and their families, which we're starting to see? And then there is the issue of the cost of the war. And that's starting to get to people in the United States. When George Bush addressed the nation and tried to tell them how cheery things were and that things, you know, people were liberated in Iraq, they didn't remember that. What they remembered was $87 billion, and people are really starting to question the cost of this war. And they are starting to question, why is it that we can spend $87 billion on top of the $78 billion that we spent in 2003, and how much is it going to be in 2005 and 2006 when we don't have money for our schools, for our healthcare system, for public transportation, for basic things that we need at home, when just about every single state in this nation is suffering from severe budget crisis, and when you add the obscene tax relief to the rich, together with this cost of war, we are seeing a bankrupting of our government and our economy here at home, and people are starting to wake up to that. And let's be encouraged. While us in this room probably think, why would anybody ever vote for George Bush or give a positive approval rating to George Bush? Well, just think of the media that we have, and that's why. And despite that, we're now George Bush as the lowest percentage of approval since he has become president. It's down to just 50% and falling. And the polls are saying now that the majority of people are questioning this occupation. The occupation is the Achilles heel of the Bush administration. The occupation can, if we get this message out to the American public, it can be the issue that turns people against George Bush together with the economy in November 2004. We have an important job ahead of us to make sure that George Bush receives the same fate as his father, a one-term president. So our job is organizing. We have the Republican convention in 2004. Everybody knows where it's taking place? New York City, absolutely crass, absolutely disgusting, as close to September 11th as they can put it, as close to ground zero as they can get it, and the people of New York are pissed. I was just in New York. They are pissed. They are saying, this is not right. This is a manipulation of our tragedy, that this must backfire on the Bush administration. And we have to make it backfire in a big way by organizing massively. And just as we organized to get millions of people around the world out on the street on February 15th, a glorious day of saying, the world says no to war, a beautiful thing to come together as a world community and say no to war, now we have a chance on August 29th, 2004, the day that the Republican convention opens, to have massive demonstrations all over this country and all over the world with one very important slogan: the world says no to Bush. And we can do that. So I want to end my talk on a very high note, because you in Santa Cruz are just the epitome of what you can do in a small community to organize, to mobilize, to educate. And I would say we need people in Santa Cruz to spread out around this country in this election. Go to the swing states, go to New York, help us mobilize in New York, pay for each other to take a leave of absence. We got to get around outside of our communities and get outside to the rest of this country and really, really organize. This is our chance. We have to get rid of Bush. We have to build our movement. We have to unite the movement against corporate-led globalization and against militarism. And we know that this is a chance in a lifetime for us when the American people can really start to wake up. So let's be excited about the opportunities ahead of us. Let's be excited about the global community that we are part of. Let's know that there is a beautiful theme that we have been organizing under, the one about another world is possible, but it's not only possible, it's being created, and we are part of creating it. And thank you for the work of Santa Cruz in building that new world.